Hello and welcome. Robots that take over the world a la Terminator, computers that beat chess grandmasters at their own game, or that cute little machine in the advert that almost gets caught being creative with the spray paint. Is that what you think of when you hear the term artificial intelligence? Well, the one in the middle, the chess-playing computer, exists and beat Garry Kasparov in 1997. And artificial intelligence already exists too in computer games and the servers that route our email, while Terminator and the cutesy robot don't yet, because what they do implies that they're sentient beings, all of which seems to suggest that we've gone some of the way towards creating a machine that thinks like a person, but not all the way. Today we'll be looking at artificial intelligence, asking what it is, why it's so difficult to replicate human-style thought, and asking, really true, as some experts say, that we're entering a defining period in its development, and if the computer sitting on your desk will, within just a few decades, have the same processing power as your brain. Well, joining me from Edinburgh, Austin Tait, Professor of Knowledge-Based Systems at the University of Edinburgh. Austin, how do you define artificial intelligence? I suspect there's an awfully long answer to this, but it's sort of short and easy answer.
Quite a short answer. It can be defined as the science and engineering would get machines to do things that a human would regard as intelligent, which is a bit of a definition that depends on your definition of human intelligence.
Yeah.
Human intelligence can have analytic, creative, practical, adaptive aspects. You know, things like interpretation, prediction, diagnosis, design, planning, and so on, learning. And certainly AI have made advances in all those areas.
But it still doesn't have the thinking power, if we're going to put it in that way, of the human brain.
Well, in narrow areas, the answer is yes, it has. If you take a holistic thing like a robot and you look at all the features it's got, you know, for vision, for hearing and understanding speech and generating speech and doing all of the things we do as humans, certainly not.
Okay. Well, one thing you speedily learn in the debate about artificial intelligence is that we seriously underestimate what our own human brains are capable of, which explains why real-life robots and computers still usually come off second best. So could one be to learn more from ourselves? Well, that's the approach taken by a project backed by the Department of Trade and Industry, the Foresight Project, which brings together computer scientists with those working with the brains of humans and animals. Now, one of the people involved has been Wendy Hall, who's Professor of Computer Science at Southampton and President of the British Computer Society. Wendy, is that an approach that's worked, the computer people learning from the brain people?
Well, it's very early days. They've really been just getting us together this year. Two completely different worlds, the neuroscientists and the computer scientists, and we've been having joint meetings and learning from each other and hoping to use that to help us do our own work better. But we're talking 10, 20 years before we might see real results of this initiative.
Is the idea that you still try to emulate the human brain, or is it a little bit more selective than that?
Well, it is more selective. I mean, in talking to the neuroscientists, I'm a computer scientist, and in talking to the neuroscientists, we're trying to find out what they know about how the brain works, which actually is still a big puzzle to us. There are bits of that puzzle that they know the answers to. And hopefully, using some of what they know, help us build better computer systems. Maybe by understanding what they know about memory, we can build systems, artificial systems, that store and retrieve from memories in more efficient ways.
Is that what you specifically were looking at, the memory aspect?
Yes, that was my particular interest, yeah.
Austin, there's this idea that the computer on your desk could have the same power as your brain within 30 years. Is that valid?
In raw processing terms, I'm sure that's going to be valid. It's a question of how we use that processing power. We've got to be clever and write intelligent system software that makes use of all that power. AI's been developing rapidly, really, right through its history, although there's been several AI winters, as some people have called them, because people have really hyped up the whole subject. We've definitely been through that two or three times in my own career. We're still on a rising trend, as far as I see it.
Okay, we'll try not to hype it up too much then. Now, like any other specialised field, artificial intelligence has its jargon, which tends to make it fairly impenetrable to the rest of us. Intelligent agents, for example, nothing to do with the X-Files. Wendy, what are intelligent agents?
Agents are really just computer processes, systems that do things for you. An agent will act on your behalf. The thing about an agent that makes it different to any other process is that they can react and be proactive, and they talk to each other as well.
So it's basically a computer program that can talk to another one.
Yes, I mean there are. Yes, it's a lot more complicated than
that,
of course.
Yes.
But yes, effectively, and they don't have to be that intelligent to be agents. You can have lots and lots of quite dumb agents that together will appear to be intelligent. But you can have lots of dumb agents that maybe are search engines, but together, if you think of Google, for example, and that's not an agent, but it's lots of systems working together that actually give you the appearance of being relatively intelligent when you ask it a question.
Okay. Awesome. You've been involved in projects with the US Defense Department for search and rescue, I think, hasn't it? Does that use agents?
Yeah. So I've been involved quite a few years with American programs, in particular in multinational coalitions. And in systems like this, you've got lots of different computer systems already created. They're running. You have to find ways to connect them rapidly. So you can use a number of ideas of agent technology to package these so that they all have a common way of communicating between themselves.
Okay, now one company that's been applying agents to its business is BT, with an intelligent systems lab testing them out to see how they could help its business as a whole. Well, joining us is Simon, who heads the research program at BT Exact. Simon, how are you thinking of using agents?
Well, at BT, we use intelligent technology to do things like allocating tasks to field engineers. Mm. And a substantial portion of the field workforce at BT has tasks allocated to them every day.
So if my phone goes down, agents are involved.
Well, an intelligent system, an intelligent scheduler, which uses a number of different methods that have been developed by the AI community over the years to actually work out what the best way to share the jobs around within the company or within a particular work patch should be.
So how would that be better than using people?
Well, it's basically a matter of having a system that can look across a very large set of data very quickly and in real time make changes to adapt to new events coming into the system, new priorities arising in the system, new things happening to the people actually doing the job. So, for instance, if you have somebody doing a job, maybe they get delayed. They have to spend an extra amount of time with the customer doing something extra. Well, that stops them from going to the next job. So then we don't want the other customer to be delayed or to miss out on their appointment. So what we do is we adapt the schedule in real time to make sure that a new engineer goes there.
Right.
And really what the computer system is doing is intelligently working out what the best person for the job at that moment should be.
So how else is BT using artificial intelligence?
Well, another example of an intelligent system would be the use we've made of machine learning capabilities to look at estimating travel time for field engineers. And when we're working out who should do what job, we need to know how long it's going to take for people to get about from place to place. And we learn from the travel patterns during a day on a particular area, and we're able to make a better estimate. And the technologies involved there are machine learning and fuzzy logic, and we're able to produce a much better estimate because we can utilise those technologies that people like Austin and Wendy have developed.
Okay. Well, one of the problems of artificial intelligence is that, sure, it can beat a chess grandmaster, but on the other hand, has problems doing what even a small child or perhaps even the family dog does with ease. Now, when AI is applied to bots, they can turn out to be pretty stupid or just plain clumsy, so no problem with them taking over the world this year anyway. Austin, why do they have these problems?
Well, I'm not sure that that's so. I just recently saw a demonstration by Sony of a boy band robot group, all singing, dancing, and doing their best not to fall over. No,
that's scary.
It sort of is, isn't it? Certainly Sony believe there's going to be a big market in these entertainment robots with little dog robots and so on.
Yeah.
More realistically, there's a lot of different aspects, as I was saying before, about trying to put together a performing robot, the vision side, the locomotion side, and as well as just the performative intelligence side, which is probably more advanced in AI today.
Is that because we ourselves are rather more complicated than we give ourselves credit for?
We're very complicated. Yeah. In fact, some of the simplest things that we take for granted are really the hard challenge problems for artificial intelligence.
Like, for example?
I'm talking about vision, speech understanding, understanding what the context that you're in and trying to adapt to that.
OK, well, robotic nonetheless is a growth industry, and joining us from Manchester is Pegman of RU Robots. Jeff, that's a reference to RUR, which was a very famous play in the 1920s, isn't it, and introduced the word robot.
Yes, that was a play by Carol Chopek, which really introduced the word robot, but really his idea was more one of a Frankenstein man-made robot rather than a mechanical being.
Okay, well, yours are nice robots, of course.
What
do you do exactly? Tell me about your robots.
We're trying to move from the area of traditional robots, which deal with uncertainty by really fixing everything down, and we're moving into areas of uncertainty. So things like construction industry, defence, food industry.
How would you use robots in, we'll say, construction for a start?
In construction industry, I mean, the main drivers, to be quite honest, there are health and safety. What you're really trying to do is to reduce some of what are quite frightening injury statistics by putting simply machines that can do the work of some of the construction workers.
Mm. I know that you've been involved in the past with bomb disposal robots. I don't think they did use artificial intelligence, but is that an area that you could use it?
It's an area where you can start using some of the techniques. I mean, the one thing you don't want to do, or the customers do not want you to do, is to introduce things like emergent behaviour, which Austin was talking about before. The idea that a bomb disposal robot could start doing something a bit different because it decided it wanted to do it is a bit frightening to people.
It is.
However, you can have automatization avoidance, so you don't collide with the arm, so you actually make the driving of the device a lot easier.
Would you actually have the technology, though, if you wanted to make a robot that would go off and do its own thing?
The technology is probably a lot more advanced than you can actually sell into the industry just right at the moment, yes. We are a long way from producing something that's human-like, but nevertheless we can produce systems that are quite competent to do a limited range of tasks.
It scares people, of course, can't it, this idea of intelligent robots?
It can, but I think we are so far away from thing that is the Terminator-type capability. I think what you are going to see is a lot more of the service robots coming into the home, into what's called edutainment, which is education and entertainment sort of combined together. So things like music bots that will take you around and give you guided tours, maybe even give you guided tours while you're sitting in front of your PC.
It's interesting that investment in robots in manufacturing has actually fallen. Does that suggest that their future is elsewhere?
Oh, yes. I mean, the International Federation of Robotics has actually got a forecast over the next 4 years for service robots, and these are the robots outside of industry, growing by something like 40% per annum over the next 4 years. So it's definitely a growth area.
This is Shop Talk on BBC Radio 4 with me, Heather Payton, and we're talking about artificial intelligence and how it's likely to affect our lives. Well, let's meet someone else across the whole business of artificial intelligence, James Matthews of the web magazine Generation 5. And he joins us from Leeds. James, one of the areas where ordinary people actually get to use AI is the very mundane application of the vacuum cleaner. I guess that's one of the service things in the home that Jeff was referring to, and these are machines that trundle around all by themselves avoiding the chair legs. Now, Electrolux have one, and there's also another one made by American firm. Are they good examples of the way AI can be applied?
They're good examples in that it's technology that's then moved into the home, which sort of demonstrates where artificial intelligence can go and where it can get accepted. But in terms of actual AI techniques, no, not really. For example, the iRobot Roomba, it's a very random path it takes. It starts to spiral about.
It's one of the cleaners, yeah.
Yeah, it just goes in different directions trying to pick dirt up, and it ends up picking up about 95%, but doesn't do it in any sort of intelligent fashion.
Where else are we seeing developments with AI?
There's a big move now in speech recognition. Is one of the big areas, because mainly our devices now, they're getting so small. You know, mobile phones are getting smaller and smaller, PDAs, and also telephone operators. These companies are trying to phase out costs. So speech recognition is becoming a big area.
Why do you need artificial intelligence for that?
Speech recognition, it's very, very hard to do for a machine just to listen to someone and try and pick out the certain words. We blur our words together. We have, for example, take the two phrases recognize speech and wreck a nice beach. You know, there's these tiny, tiny differences that are very, very hard for machines to recognize, but for humans just come naturally.
Are we going to see more of this sort of thing? I mean, still smarter machines, or is it going to be more of them, or how's it going to go in the future, do you think?
I think the big problem now is the social issues. Out here in the West, we're very wary of technology. There's this big sort of technophobia. And we're going to see that the technology is going to snowball. It's already started. And it's just a case of getting people to see robots as not something so threatening. So, yeah, there's going to be more intelligent machines. They're going to slowly push into the society, but not in this Terminator Matrix fashion that we've seen.
Okay. Now, one of the things human beings can still do better than machines, even intelligent ones, is experience emotions. Well, that's despite the sci-fi books and movies that would have it otherwise. Sometimes, of course, that puts us humans at a real disadvantage. But emotions are, in fact, fundamental to the way we make decisions. James Silver has been to Birmingham to find out if the robots are catching up.
In the future, there will be robots that can learn to survive in any new surroundings.
I'm at the Think Tank Museum of Science and Discovery in Birmingham with Professor Noel Sharkey, Senior Media Research Fellow at the Engineering and Physical Sciences Research Council. He's also a judge for TV's Robot Wars. But instead of machines smashing each other up today, at Think Tank he's created a robot that uses more subtle power. Noel, we're standing in front of what looks like a human-sized rudimentary face. Just tell me a little bit about it.
Well, the idea here is to get a robot that can convey emotion with the minimal amount of elements. You can see that it's not animatronic at all. It's not got a fleshy face. It's all little parts like spoons and camera eyes. It looks as if it's smiling, it's being angry, it's chatting now.
How does it work?
It's got a set of 19 little servo motors. That's the kind of motors you get on model racing cars. And they work the lips and eyes and the eyebrows. And it's got some sensors on it, so it will detect that you're here and respond to you. One of the things I'm trying to convey is there are some universal emotional expressions. Angry, sad, happy, and disgust. And there's a little nose there that lifts up and points, and that's especially for disgust. But one of the good features of this are the pupils. The pupils dilate when it's happy, just like a human does, and no other robot has done that before. It's a very strong emotional signal, and although you don't realise it, you don't notice it particularly, it's subtle, it makes you think it's being very happy or it's being very sad.
So Emo looks emotional.
Yes.
But is it emotional? Can it ever be emotional?
No, I don't think it could ever be emotional. It's just a set of little motors working these things. Now, there are arguments, good arguments in artificial intelligence, that if it functions like it's got emotion, therefore it is emotion. But let me just dispel that with a simple idea. If I was to take this robot as it stands now, you can see the little motors are working, the lips and the nose and the eyes and the eyebrows. And if I was to take those off, but keep it just the same as it is now and leave the motors there. Put some brushes on them and a little dustpan. I could hold it upside down and use it as a sweeper so I could get alternatively to be angry and happy, and that would move those servos so it would sweep the floor. But would it be happy or sad? No.
Can you ever foresee the day where emotional robots and emotional artificial intelligence exist?
I don't think so at all. Not in the current form. I couldn't say that there could never be a machine that would feel emotion, but I don't think it would be a kind of silicon computer like we've got now. I mean, I think that it's partly integrated into our entire bodies. We feel anxious throughout our bodies. It's chemical, really, I think. So maybe one day we'll have a sort of biochemical machine that will feel emotion, but not one of these things.
Well, we're surrounded by some of your other robots.
One or two, yeah.
Describe a few of those for us.
These are little autonomous robots with shells. You can see the kids playing with them. And these were designed specifically for contests for children. And what you have is you have a big robot that moves around an arena. And children from as young as 7 come along and program these little ones to hunt it down, track it down, and thump it. And what we're doing is we're doing a research project at the moment of getting these to behave like sheep and 2 bigger robots that are herding them. And they could be then used in industry because big ones will have navigational control, more sophisticated, so they can drive them from place to place, like in a nuclear fuel place, to do decommissioning.
Noel, what's next in robot production for you?
We're building a mobile Emo that can actually walk around and shrug its shoulders and make more gestures. And it's currently having a showreel made for it because it might appear as a co-presenter on a TV program on emotion.
That's very interesting. So, stardom beckons.
Well, there's stardom for emo.
Professor Noel Sharkey and Think Tank's emo. Many thanks.
James Silver was our reporter. Now, Noel Sharkey, whom he spoke to, was a decided sceptic on the idea of emotional robots. Austin, do you agree with the view that we may be able to get robots to show emotion but not to feel it?
Well, it depends on whether you see emotions as something only humans can express, really. If they're very fundamental aspects like desire or pleasure or fear, why not use those as guides for how we program devices to make them perform better in real environments?
Could react, but not feel in the same sense that
feel
humans...
it's difficult, isn't it? What happens when a pin's pushed into your hand, and and when you see someone coming towards your hand with a pin, what's actually happening physiologically? I aren't sure. I don't do that kind of research, but certainly computers that are aware of the user's emotions, I think, could be a really important thing. So we have models of what we mean by emotion, and we use that to improve the dialogues we have with users.
James, what do you think about this robots or artificial intelligence that feels emotion rather than just showing it?
Yeah, I think there's a certain perspective that people take that machine intelligence is going to be like human intelligence and any machine emotions are going to be like human emotions. But I think currently the human brain, the human intelligence is such a black box system that looking at machines and saying, yes, they can or can't feel emotions is slightly off the mark. So I think machines could feel some sort of emotion at some stage.
Or something we define as emotion.
Yeah, something, because if we see a response from a machine and say it's feeling emotion, then as far as we can see right now, it is.
Thompson of BT, do you think BT could use systems that have some sort of emotion, either show emotion or react to emotion or whatever?
I think certainly. I think that understanding when our customers are frustrated might help our web systems present information more readily. It's important to understand why humans are a particular thing in order to be able to make the computer respond to them.
Interesting. Jeff Pegman, in the sort of business you're in, I mean, how would your clients react to the idea of robots showing emotion? I mean, Mike, it was a little bit creepy.
I think if you look in the industrial environment, then yes, that would be seen as something that probably at the moment was not acceptable. However, in the domestic environment, then showing emotion, whether that's real or just imagined, is a great benefit. Japanese researchers recently did a very good coup in that they gave the Japanese Prime Minister a seal that just reacted to being stroked, and he spent a whole entire conference stroking this seal. A robot seal.
Interesting. Okay. Well, we talked earlier about how robots can be possibly a bit on the clumsy side, not always good at trotting around using their own navigation. So how about the idea of automated travel vehicles driven by intelligent systems rather than by people? Now, would you feel confident about getting into the back seat of one? But in an effort to get things going in that area, the US Defense Department's research arm that Austin's been working with, in fact, is holding a race in March for automated vehicles. Now, the route is Los Angeles to Las Vegas with a prize of $1 million. Wow. Jeff, you've been into this, haven't you?
We had a talk with some of the organisations in the US, yes, indeed.
You're tempted to get involved?
We were tempted, but to be quite honest, there is a lot of effort involved in actually producing technology for that challenge.
What was the difficulty?
The difficulty is that you are driving 200 miles, 250 miles, in 10 hours or less, off-road, through the desert, on some roads, and the system has to be completely autonomous.
So it can't be sort of remote-controlled or anything like that?
It can't be remote-controlled. It has to sense its own environment. It has to deal with the environment as it finds it. And it's not a route that you can pre-prepare for.
Mm. What's the point of all of this? I mean, how could automated vehicles help the Defense Department in the States?
The Defense Department is very interested in sort of semi-autonomous and autonomous vehicles, the idea being that for things like search and reconnaissance missions, rather than sending people out there, you can actually send robots. And the robots can actually investigate the environment, find out what's out there and where the threats are.
And of course, this is quite interesting at a time when they're talking about UK armed services cuts as well, isn't it?
Yes, and indeed, the idea there is they want to use more intelligent systems. And that's not just robots, that's the whole intelligence, which includes some artificial intelligence, being incorporated within all of the systems.
What about commercial applications?
The commercial applications sort of come out of that and run side by side. I go back to the big areas, really, that you're going to see artificial intelligence in robots is going to be in the domestic environment and in the edutainment.
Austin, is this an important part of the development of AI, the sort of things that Jeff's talking about?
Yeah, I've been dying to come in on that one.
Go
because,
on, then.
robots aren't always about humanoid two-legged systems, and some of these vehicles that are going to do the DARPA Grand Challenge across the desert, these are a focus for vehicles like normal commercial systems that you would see driving around. So already there has been an AI-controlled vehicle run all the way across America on freeways in normal traffic. And except for a very small part around Denver where they had to put hands on for safety, the system was able to run all the way across America. So this is the level at which some of those vehicles are performing. And you've got to realise that robots are out there in deep space as well. There was a NASA called Deep Space One where it was run for 48 hours completely autonomously by onboard AI. And you imagine if you've got a vehicle out near Jupiter or Saturn, you can sometimes be right by the moon or the planet that you're investigating before you can send back a control signal. So if we've got adaptive onboard intelligence out there, it means if you do see something interesting like a volcano that just goes off as you're approaching, you can reprogram all your sensors and devices.
Do you think briefly that we are about to see big developments in artificial intelligence? I mean, is it about to enter all our consciousnesses and our lives?
I think it is, mainly because of one thing, and that's the development of the web. The web is now coming to a point where it isn't just a place you go for information and images. It's a place where you can go for services, you can put together those services, and you can interact with it in ways which are going to allow you access to more intelligent services. And many people today, myself and Wendy, for instance, involved in a UK programme called Advanced Knowledge Technologies. All of our effort now is going towards packaging intelligent services and providing them on the semantic web.
Wendy, what do you think? Big development soon?
I think it's continuous. If you use the web, you're using artificial intelligence systems that have been developed using artificial intelligence. If you use Amazon, they use what's called recommender systems.
These are the books we recommend for you, yes.
Exactly, because other people that bought this book have read this one. And as Austin said, we're moving into the next generation of the web, which is often referred to as the semantic web, where we're actually working, as he said, on techniques to add intelligence to the web so that not only humans can understand what's out there better, but also the agents that are constantly surfing around the web can understand the documents that they're actually handling.
Brings to mind an extraordinary picture. Thanks to all of you for that. Wendy Hall of Southampton University, Austin Tate of Edinburgh University, Jeff Pegman of RU Robots, James Matthews of Generation 5, and Simon Thompson of BT Exact. There's more on the website, the intelligent website, bbc.co.uk/radio4, and then follow the links to Shop Talk. We're back next week. I hope you'll join us.